Thank you, we're in public tax committee order. I apologize, members and the public, for the room. The room was taken by a very small amount of people. Took our big room, and a whole bunch of people get to come into a little room. So, sorry if it gets a little, when everyone gets here, it might get a little hot and smelly in here, but we'll open the side doors if it does. So, Representative Dabney, I didn't mean to catch you off guard, but the first two officers aren't here yet. So, here, we just go right to you, and so, we don't have a quorum yet, but when we do, we'll move your bill. Representative Dabney, you want to tell us what you're up to in House File 1980, Digital Project Tax.
All right. Oh, thank you, Pat. Good. I'm the cavalry that's around. good afternoon, Madam Chair. What we are doing with House File 1980, extending the Minnesota sales tax to digital downloads, is really two things. One, we're making our sales tax more rational, more logical. And two, we're assisting Main Street businesses in Minnesota. Thank you. Here's the issue. If I buy this CD of music in Minnesota, I pay sales tax. If I download that same music in my basement from the iTunes store, I pay no sales tax.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, what CD are you buying?
It's buying rate. I think Representative David, Madam Chair, Representative David, I think I picked this up after a concert, where of course I paid sales tax on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
He may have stolen that. I don't know.
Right. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Well, you picked it up after a concert.
What's the thing about that? The t-shirt. But that's not
exactly.
Tax, as you know.
That's not tax.
Although I think there's a proposal.
Representative
Dabney. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. If I buy a piece of software in Minnesota for my phone at a store, I pay sales tax. If I download that same software onto my phone, I don't pay any sales tax. So, how about 1980 by extending the sales tax to digital downloads simply rationalizes our sales tax system and assists Main Street businesses that are being have an uneven playing field versus the big out of state companies that specialize in digital downloads. With that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there testifiers for or against this bill? And Representative Dabney, I know other states are around us are doing this very thing already. Others are proposing it. Representative Dabney.
In members' packet is a map from the Wisconsin Journal, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the newspaper of my childhood, that shows the states that as of the time of this map, I believe a year ago, were taxing digital downloads. If members want to take out their markers or crayons, they can now color in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin only recently moved to taxing digital downloads. I've heard two different numbers as I've done research on this bill, either 19 or 21 states. So there's a growing number of states that are taxing digital downloads. Madam Chair, when we get to the point of doing it, I do need to move a delete all amendment. That, as I understand it, does not change the intent of the bill significantly, except for eliminating a tax proposed in the original bill on periodicals, online periodicals. The bulk of this, as I understand it, is technical language. And if need be, when the time comes, Ms. Dalton could speak to that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dabney, can you tell me again on the map of all the states that already do this? Can you tell me to color in which state? Wisconsin?
Color in Wisconsin.
Okay, so if Wisconsin's colored in, we now know this many states are already doing this.
Yes, and Mr. Kranz might be able to color in more than that.
I'm not sure. Or erase some of them, because that is a...
Okay, so hang on a second. Okay, so Mr. Kranz, welcome. Do you want to introduce yourself so we know who you are for the tape?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. My name is Steve Kranz. I'm a state local tax lawyer with the Sutherland Law Firm in Washington, D.C. I specialize there in state impact of digital downloads, and I've worked on this issue really since 2000 when Jenny Ames from the Minnesota Department of Revenue and myself were sparring about some issues in the streamlined sales tax project. I've been working on this issue with a group of companies that are monitoring around the country and following what's going on from state local taxation of digital downloads, whether it's music, movies, books, software, online dating services, online career and resume services. There are a whole host of services out there that are being delivered electronically, and as states are looking for money, they're considering extending their sales tax to the services arena. So this is, it's not a new issue, but it's one that does have broad-sweeping ramifications, and I'd like to talk for a little bit about the perspective of the consumer on this issue, the perspective of the Minnesota business on this issue, and the perspective of the state's participation in the streamlined sales tax effort. From the consumer standpoint, and I do want to apologize, I haven't had a chance to look through the lead all amendments, and I know that some of the issues I'll be talking about have been addressed there, but from the consumer perspective, this is a new tax on downloaded movies, music, and books. It is also, as originally drafted, a potential tax on online dating services and online career services. I don't think that that was the intention of the bill, but this is a very difficult area of PACT law, and drafting these bills, if we've seen them come up around the country, this requires very technical, detailed drafting. Washington State, for example, spent a year in a committee that was hosted by their legislature, their Department of Revenue, and many of the large high-tech companies that are present in Washington. They spent a year drafting their bill. And it was, they spent that time to make sure that things like dating services and online career job hunting services were not accidentally swept in. When you say you want to tax the digital world, what do you mean? Do you mean you just want to tax the equivalent or near equivalent of a CD? Do you mean you want to tax anything that's delivered electronically over the internet? The other technical issues that came up in the original draft were that the bill, in imposing tax on digital audiovisual services or digital audiovisual work, could impose tax on downloaded movies that you get over the internet, but it would also impose sales tax a second time on cable service, because cable is a digital audiovisual work. The other technical problem that we saw in the original draft was that video games, which are already subject to tax in Minnesota as pre-written computer software, would be taxed a second time under the bill's original definition of other digital products. So there are some technical issues that I think can be worked out in this bill that would impact the consumer. The bill also imposes tax on what I think of as a set of green products. Digital products are environmentally friendly. They have almost no carbon footprint compared to the tangible counterpart. And a downloaded song does not have a plastic wrapper, does not come in a cardboard box that's shipped over our interstate system to retail stores where consumers have to drive to the store to buy the product. You would be imposing tax on a green set of products at a time when nationally people are trying to encourage green initiatives and the development and prosperity of high-tech green products. The Recording Industry Association of America and a number of other groups have submitted letters on this bill. And one of the things that you'll see raised by them, by the motion picture industry, is a concern that taxing the digital world will lead to greater piracy. And in the music world, right now, about 90% of the music that's downloaded is pirated. It's illegal copies. Imposing tax on the remaining 10% punishes the consumers and the businesses who are engaged in legitimate commerce and will have some impact on that 10%, pushing them away from legitimate purchases into pirated purchases and illegal copies. From the business perspective, this proposal, while I understand the desire to level the playing field between Main Street retailers and the online providers of music or books or movies, it's the same issue that this state and others are facing in the tangible world. If I buy a book
from my bookstore here, a hard copy book. That bookstore is going to collect sales tax. But if I buy a book from a remote retailer that doesn't have nexus in the state, doesn't have a physical presence here, Minnesota can't require that online seller to charge sales tax. That's why Minnesota's been involved in the Streamline Sales Tax Project. It's why Congress is considering overturning the Quill case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that defines the physical presence rule. This bill would exacerbate the problem that exists under Quill today. It would say to your Minnesota companies that sell digital products, you have to charge sales tax on music, movies, and books that you sell digitally. But it cannot, because of the Constitution, it cannot do anything to force the remote seller of those products to collect. So all the bill does, at the end of the day, is discriminate against Minnesota companies, forcing them to collect tax and causing their consumers to shift from one website to another. Shift to a website of a company that's based somewhere else and buy tax-free. As a matter of fact, North Dakota Senator Dwight Cook has recently supported and gotten legislation passed in that state that exempts all products delivered electronically. The intention of that bill, and you can see in its press around it, is an effort to draw in the high-tech companies that feel they're being burdened by taxes like the one that was just passed in Wisconsin. North Dakota is sending a message. They're open for business to the high-tech community. A recent bill in New York was just defeated based on this concern. Last year, a bill in California to tax digital goods was defeated when the in-state company said, if you impose this tax, you're punishing us for being here. And you're sending a message, don't invest in this state, don't locate here. In California, the message was, we'll do business from Oregon, and we'll sell the same digital product from a website that's based in an Ethernet, in an Internet without boundaries. The consumer doesn't know the difference. But from a competitive standpoint, there is a difference to consumers. They don't pay the tax on one set website, they do on another. Logically, purchasing patterns are going to shift. And as I mentioned, North Dakota exempts all digital goods. Iowa has historically exempted all digital goods. Wisconsin was the first state in this area to impose tax on it. It was done as part of the budget bill there that passed within the last month. Wyoming's another state that just moved an exemption bill. So while there are, I think, at the end of the day, about 13 states that legislatively impose tax on digital goods, there are seven states that claim they impose tax on digital goods that are reflected in that map, but there's no legislative authority for it. It's Department of Revenue positions in those states. For the state of Minnesota, the issue of taxing digital is really, it should be a timing issue. There's an effort to get Quill overturned. A bill will be introduced in Congress in the next week that would do that, and that bill stands a better chance this year than it ever has before. Once Quill is overturned, then Minnesota can require its sellers and the sellers based in Washington and California and Oregon and any other state to collect its tax. But until the Quill rule is reversed, the legislation would just punish companies who have invested and built in Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Crane. Okay. Representative Dabney, we do have a quorum. And are there other testifiers for or against this bill? Please come forward if there are. Representative Dabney, did you want to move? Let's see. Representative Dabney moves House Bill 1980. And you have an amendment.
If I can move the H-1980-DE2 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Dabney moves the DE2 amendment to get in the form he'd like it. Is there discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Amendment is adopted. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, for those who still have their markers or crayons out, according to CNET News, you can color in Nebraska on your map as well. The chair and members will remember that I did teach middle school geography. There's an awful lot of colored pencil work in my background.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
David.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I to understand correctly from the previous testifier that Representative Dabney, your bill would add to the severe threat of global warming?
Representative Dammey, are you no longer green?
Oh,
Madam Chair,
I might turn red. Madam Chair, Representative Davids, in doing research on this, I came across a website where they were discussing that, and the point of one of the posters was that's only the issue if you think that computer servers are run on pixie dust, because of course they're run on electricity, and electricity is generated in a variety of ways, not all of which would meet everyone's definition of green.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, you know, and I'll just tell you, Representative Dabney, just thinking about that, I mean, I am not a big fan of trying to control behavioral impacts on the environment and the tax bill one way or another. And I think Minnesota's been pretty good about not rewarding people to do green things, but that's not what the tax code is for. But we have a lot of members here bipartisanly who have things like green job bills and all that stuff that, they would make the tax code much greener. I'm not a fan of them personally, and they cost money, but even President Obama is trying to, or in fact has passed all these sort of green initiatives in the tax code, and shame on him. But so whether you're green or not, I don't know that we really want to try to get into those impacts and the tax system as it relates to what should be, have a sales tax or not. So do you have anyone else who wanted to testify, or is there anyone here who's for or against this bill? If not, we're going to just lay it over for Representative Bill. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I wanted to just, my first thought about what I was going to say doesn't really have anything to do with taxes. It has to do with the green business. But as I think about it, it really does have a tremendous, phenomenal impact on taxes. And that is precious metal mining that's being proposed in northern Minnesota. I just wanted to let you know that the companies that are doing this media thrive on computers that have 15 to 16 precious metals in them, of which we tax to beat the band, and bring in billions of dollars of revenue for the state. So it's a great green bill, because in other countries we don't have anywhere near the environmental protection that we will have in Minnesota when we mine those same metals. So not only is it taxes, but it's also green. So start thinking of mining as a green industry.
Very strategic move on Representative Bill. For another bill. For another day. Very nice. Representative Dammey. Oh, Representative Gardner. Sorry. Is he here? Representative Gardner. Sorry.
Ed, two questions. When you order a product online, you enter your address, and then it'll say, you know, if you're a Arkansas resident, pay 7%, whatever the thing is. And there's a delivery address where that's usually linked to. But in this case, you could be in California, be a Minnesota resident, and go to a computer or just have your iPhone around and get stuff from wherever, no matter what state you're in. And I'm just curious how that would work for determining if it was on a national basis or state basis. How would it be determined that you pay tax on that? A little satellite telling you if you're in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I'm fully capable of speculating, but I think I'd rather ask, phone a friend here.
Ms. Dalton, welcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, there are rules already regarding downloadables, because we do actually tax some downloadables in the state. We actually tax non-customized computer software, regardless of how it is delivered. So if you go onto a website and download the latest version of Word, you're subject to sales tax. So there are privacy rules that already exist related to that, and basically it comes down to billing address. So, you have a credit card. You can't just get a credit card, so you have a billing address, and that's essentially what this is.
When I had my other question, this is sort of a bigger picture one, and I don't know if Mr. Kranz has thought about this either, but we have a paper industry in Minnesota too, and we've seen a decline of the printing industry as well as the newsprint industry, although we don't make newsprint in Minnesota. And the whole issue is now surrounding whether we're going to have any newspapers left in 5 years, and how do we determine how to charge users for digital media that they used to pay for. And there's a tax equation in there, too. And I don't know if this is too mind-blowing a question, but how are we going to approach that as we do start to go digital. I don't think anyone figured out how we're going to do that. People have talked about charging you by article or in-depth piece that you get a certain amount of stuff free. Maybe that's just a comment. I don't know how we're going to cope with this, but we're going to be here again on other digital-related stuff and taxation. And, you know, we just had this 21st Century Tax Commission yesterday with business people said, here's the taxes you cut to spur business growth, and here's the taxes you raise. And all the taxes, Mrs. or Mr. Krantz, were on consumption to pay for the business stuff, so we don't pass all the stuff on the business. So we're starting to move more, according to the business community here, towards taxing consumption, and digital media is part of consumption. So we're kind of being told two different things by two different folks, and we have to sort it out to figure out what's going to work.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative
Danny,
and then we have
Broadenville.
Danny.
Madam Chair, two quick things in response to Representative Gardner's last question. One of the differences between the DE2 and the bill as originally introduced is the bill as originally introduced did tax periodicals. Overwhelmingly, we do not tax paper periodicals in the state. And so that was that portion of the original bill was deleted with the DE2 amendment. So going to that, and then also I just want to correct the record. At the beginning of this bill hearing, I held up some software, and I apparently shouldn't have. So just want to correct the record there. I would have paid tax on it either way.
Okay, Representative Broadenville.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if this was covered before I got here, I'd check into another committee just to tell me, and I'll get the answers myself. But two questions, probably for Ms. Dalton. The tax forms that you can download, TurboTax, would that be taxed?
Ms. Dalton?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I may look at Joel. If you download TurboTax, the computer program, it is a standard, a non-customized computer program, and it would be downloadable. To the extent that those forms are part of it, it's part of the, and you know, you pay for those forms as you're paying for the software package. Yes, it's part of that taxable item.
And that's current.
And that would be current law. That's not a change in due to this bill.
Right. And I was just kind of curious. And then Madam Chair and Ms. Dalton, do you have a, is there a breakdown of the ages of folks who are downloading things off the internet that would be taxed under this bill? I'm trying to get a sense of demographics, who this hits, how it hits income levels, you know, things along those lines. Is there any way to gauge some of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I don't have any type of demographic information. I would guess there is some available, certainly for at least some of the different types of digital products that are listed here. And, you know, if you're interested in that, I can work with the Department of Revenue to find out some of the
information. Great,
thanks. Thank you. Representative Bill.
No problem.
Yeah, okay. Anyone else with a public for or against this bill? If not, we're going to lay this bill open for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Danny. And we're going to go to Representative Demmer, if you're ready to go. And I want to apologize to the committee about Representative Demmer. So he doesn't know what I'm saying, what I'm saying. Representative Demmer thought his bill didn't cost money. So I was willing to schedule it. But in fact, it does. And so members of the committee know I have not heard any bills that cost money this year. They either have to be a zero bill or they have to raise revenue to pay for their idea. And Representative Norton's going to have a bill up here later today that we're going to hear it informationally only. She has a high school student who's going to testify. Representative Demmer talked to me about this and thought it didn't have a cost, but it appears the revenue estimate shows it does cost something. So with the committee's leave, I hope that's okay, because we have not been hearing bills that show up as a cost item on the spreadsheet. And why is that? Of course, just reminding the audience, because we have a deficit of $6.4 billion. Now, this committee has a target of raising $1.5 billion, and anything that costs money, I'm moving us in the wrong direction there. So we've been trying to be very bipartisan and fair and not hearing them. Okay, so I really do want to apologize, because the revenue estimate shows it's a million something in the first year and then $4.9 million, whatever. And I'll tell you that I have turned down Representative Kelly, who had an $8,000 bill, and Representative Fulmer, who had a $13,000 bill, and a number of members on both sides of the aisle who have very, very negligible numbers, but we've been consistent not to hear them. So I don't want to blame Representative Demmer. I don't think he knew that either, and he anticipated that the revenue estimate would show that it didn't cost him anything. So if the committee is okay with hearing it anyhow, I think we should go ahead and do that, because there was no intent by anybody here to have a bill hearing today that was going to cost money. And again, we do have one more that we're going to hear as an informational item only. So Representative Demmer, you want to go ahead and move your bill. I don't see any committee members objecting, so we're just going to do it anyhow. So Representative Demmer moves House File 937, and Representative Demmer, you have an amendment to get it in the form you like it?
I do, Madam Chair. It could be either.
So Representative Demmer moved that amendment. I'm just looking, do we have it, members? Can we get the amendment passed out? It says on the summary, it's an 80937 DE1 amendment. So maybe Megan has that. Okay, we're going to get copies. So we won't move it yet until everyone's in front of us. But go ahead, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry about the amendment. I thought that we had that done. It doesn't change the substance of the bill. It's some language that Dee thought we had to have because of reporting deadlines. I'm going to go ahead with what I was going to say. I'm very curious about the revenue estimate. I thought we checked into those things, and I've got a hunch as to what I think it might be, and if that's the case, we can discuss that too. Madam Chair, members, the reason I brought this bill forward, it came from a conversation I had with a business in my district that's a job Z business, and I was in a social event actually visiting with him, and I said, how are things going? He's actually related to the construction business. And I said, how are things going with the economy the way it is and this and that? And he said, well, quite frankly, it's going fine, but you know, he's been a job Z for a couple of years, and they've been doing well. They made investment, and business is growing. We had talked before about how he'd, you know, gone way beyond his job requirements for the job Z, and working like a charm. And he said, this is just really a great thing, and we're in business now because of it. But he said, he's in the cement truck business.
Excuse me, Representative, someone's cell phone is on. So I just want to tell you, if your cell phone's on, please turn it off, and putting it on vibrate will not solve this problem. You have to have it actually off in this room. So it could be anybody here, including members. Representative Demmer.
Anyway, he's in the cement truck business. And he said, you know, this downturn in the economy is nationwide, and he does business all over the country. And he said, we're quite frankly having difficulty hanging on to all the employees. We were above the level. Now we're back down near the level of where we're supposed to be for job Z, and I'm a little worried about falling below. He asked about it. He never did fall below. He stayed there because he was traveling around and doing more selling and that sort of thing. They made it. But I said, really? And I said, isn't there any kind of consideration given there? I mean, you've been a job Z business for a couple of years. You've exceeded your investment requirements. You've exceeded your job requirement. I would think there'd be some sort of latitude. They'd do something with you. And he said, well, we were told by Dee that they can't because of what you guys did last year in the legislature. I said, really? So I looked into it when I got back up here. And sure enough, you know, we had the OLA's report last year talking about some of the difficulties with the administration of job Z and what we were doing with it, and quite frankly, I supported tightening things up. But one of the unintended consequences is when we have situations where we have people who've already been there, they're going along, in the economy the way we have, as you know, we're trying to keep businesses going, people are laying people off and trying to minimize that, and this is something that's a real issue. These businesses, again, I drafted this bill quite narrowly, because it's intended specifically for businesses who have been there, who've met the requirements, both jobs as well as investment. And I also limited the scope of time that they could work with BEAD if they have something that's beyond their control that causes a change in their business that they wouldn't be able to maybe fall below in terms of the number of folks that they've hired after they've already met the requirements. So I drafted and I said in a 2-year window of time, that has to be readdressed. And if you're not there, bottom line, you may come out. But that's the way I drafted the thing. I contacted Dee. They said, yes, indeed, this is an issue. Subsequently, I came across this article in Twin Cities that was dealing with this issue. And so quite frankly, that's how I brought the bill forward. I'm surprised about the revenue estimate, but maybe after Mr. Loftus is finished, we can talk about why that is. Because I haven't read it, obviously, so I don't know where they're getting the numbers from. So.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Loftus, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm with Dee.
We have obviously testified to this committee many times about Job Z, and just to summarize quickly, that we have transformed the program in terms of the administration and the oversight. We have significant new controls on companies that enter the program. Since October, when we instituted the new application process, we have approved six projects and actually turned down two projects that it's likely to say that in past years would have been approved without by local governments without our oversight. We've also encouraged a number of projects not to come forward based on the fact that they're likely not to qualify. So that aspect of the oversight and the administrative approval by deed is certainly part of our process, and I wanted you to be aware of that. We also have a much better handle on the compliance process as well. A number of companies that we know today in a way that we did not know last year when we testified to you is how many companies are in full compliance. Based on last year's statute, we have determined that several companies also would remain in the program but would have reduced duration of benefits, which is one of your provisions last year, that there are companies that are still operating in the zone but had their benefits ended and are not subject to clawback based on your provisions last year, and also a fairly large group of companies that are subject to clawback because they're fully out of compliance. And Beth Gavin was here from Revenue to talk about that, ask you questions about the clawback process. But in the process of looking at the compliance activities, we receive annual reports from companies under the business subsidy law that are due April 1st. So yesterday was the first day that we really got a batch of applications in. And we have made a rough guesstimate based on around 100 applications that have come in that probably in the range of the overall 324 in the program, that we could expect that there may be in the range of 20 to 40 businesses somewhere, low to high side. It's hard to say exactly yet. The companies that have met their goals, we're not talking about companies that never complied, that didn't reach their goals, but that met their target, met their business subsidy requirements, and then for a variety of reasons, which we think are probably mostly due to the state of the economy these days, fall below that. And as a matter of policy, we wanted to bring it forward, and Representative Demmer was helpful in particularly knowing a couple of businesses in his area that have been benefited by Job Z. We felt that we needed to bring that to your attention, and we support this legislation and have helped develop it because of our belief as a matter of policy, the companies that have achieved their goals should not be penalized because they fell short due to the economy. So giving us the latitude to have up to two year extension, not in all cases, but as we determine on a case by case basis that authority, which we do not have now.
Thank you, Mr. Lantis. And I think it would be helpful to ask if that's all right, Representative Emory, have Assistant Commissioner Kundun come up and fill that last piece, and then also since you can tell us why the revenue estimate cost the money that it cost. So if you can join us, Ms. Kundun, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadillo, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. As Mark Loss just mentioned, the clawback provisions that are provided in law, there is back in the census, to remind you, in 2008, there were some Job Z law changes, and one of those is requiring a mandatory Job Z certification that businesses needed to file with the Department of Revenue by December 1st of 2008 was the first report that was due by these companies, and the report also then allowed 30-day late filing for these companies. So the process for clawbacks is we're just received those forms back and have gone through them and reviewed them to see which companies would be subject to clawback. We'd identified 25 of these Job Z companies that would be potentially subject to clawback. Under the current clawback statute as well, is what it says is that we could clawback 2 years of taxes from the date of noncompliance. And then unless until a business halts Job Z activities, they may not be subject to clawback under Job Z law. We have clawbacked a few of those companies at this point. There's been numerous ones that have also been clawbacked for property tax purposes. I don't have the exact dollar figure for you on that as well. We received also a handful of waiver requests I think about four at this point from these companies, and we're currently in a review. And as I mentioned, the forms really started coming back and the review process with fees, so we're really undertaking the clawback termination for those other 29 companies.
Can you also talk about the revenue estimate?
For the revenue estimate?
Members have it in their packet.
If you go under really the revenue analysis detail is provided in those bullet points, and what it does is assume with, you know, what the current law is. And if you go to the proposal, it would assume that for the job businesses that would be eligible to amend their business subsidy agreements. And we're assuming then there would be about 35 in calendar year 2009, 35 in 2010, and 10 annually thereafter that would be allowed to potentially amend their returns and thereby be eligible for their job fee benefits to continue that would not otherwise be eligible under current law. So that's why you see the revenue cost.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Other questions for Rufin Demmer, Ms. Padoon, Ms. Loftus, Mr. Loftus? If not, is there anyone from the public who wants to testify for or against this bill? Oh, and Rufin Demmer now moves. Apologize. We've got it now, Rufin Demmer moves the 80937 DE1 amendment. Discussions the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. And Representative Demmer, unless there's something else, we'll lay it over for a possible inclusion. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Nancy. Well, first of all, DE1 again, the department's lead came to me and said, you know, we need to make sure that we are clear as to which businesses we're making eligible, and that's what the DE1 does. I guess the only comment I'd make, and I apologize for the revenue estimate, I thought we'd requested one, maybe I just assumed that we wouldn't have any. And it's basically what this is saying that if these businesses are charged back for their taxes, and we assume that some will be, there's going to be a cost. That's analogous to Madam Chair just saying, well, if we do away with all the Job Z programs, which I know you've had a bill to do that, we would have revenue for the state of Minnesota. It's the same thing. You know, from a philosophical standpoint, you know, these are businesses that have met the requirements. They're doing what we ask them to do. This is a tough economy. We know the national government as well as state government are doing lots of things to try to create jobs, lots of things trying to help people to either start up and or maintain what they're doing. And I think it's a poor policy on the part of the state of Minnesota when we have people who've met the requirements, have done what they need to do, they've hired people, and now due to this economic downturn, and quite frankly, a lot of these are small businesses that are putting personal money in to keep things going. For us to allow this hit to possibly put some of them out of business at a time we're trying to keep and create jobs, I think would be bad policy. We're not creating anything new. We're not setting up a new program. We're simply saying, you've done what you've done. We want to keep you going and stay a partner with you as a state. And so that's why this is here, Madam Chair. So with that, I renew my motion for the DE1. Thanks for that.
Thank you. And we'll lay this open for possible inclusion on this tax. Representative Norton, is your testifier here? Okay. Representative Norton, members who came in late, I apologize, as did Representative Demmer. We haven't been hearing any bills that cost any money this year because we have a deficit we're trying to fill, not increase spending. And so, although we have heard some because we spent 6 days on the governor's proposal and he had a lot of new initiatives and we actually talked about green jobs a lot. So the Demmer bill got on here sort of accidentally because he did not think it cost money and so there was no intention to sort of get around what we've been trying to do this year. And members should know, you know, if you have a bill that costs money and you're willing to raise the revenue to pay for it, of course we're going to hear it. Representative Norton and I think had a miscommunication when I was trying to let her know that her tax bill that was out there floating in other committees needed to get back to taxes, really for the tax committee to keep possession of it. I think she thought that meant I couldn't wait to pass it. And so she has a student with her who was ready to testify on it. And so we've scheduled this bill as an informational hearing only. We're not going to actually move it and lay it over. We're just going to hear about it today. So Representative Norton, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for your patience with this. And I'm going to present a little opening, and then Unit Choice is a Century High School 11th grader. She has studied this issue as part of our mentorship agreement, and then she'll do some testimony, and I think she's fully prepared to answer questions, as am I. Madam Chair and members, really appreciate your hearing House File 72, which is Lifelong Learning Accounts. This bill has been given some preliminary hearings last year where Speaker Kelleher and Representative Carlson carried the bill. After attending the Women in Government conference this summer on the higher ed portion, this was one of the topics of conversation, and Representative Kahn and Senator Sharon and I attended that and decided that this was really worthy and we should bring it forward again. So through meetings this summer with those individuals, as well as Kale, as well as Dean, you have the bill before you. Lifelong learning accounts are employer-matched, portable, individual accounts, and you'll hear a little bit more about that from Una. Too often we see investments in our children's education as a public good, but investment in adult learning is often considered a private good. Given our changing demographics, our shrinking younger working pool, and the trend toward multiple job changes for employees, it's time we change that mindset. According to a 2002 Hudson Institute study, 60% of the newly created jobs require skills that only 20% of U.S. workers possess. Estimates suggest that by 2014, the U.S. labor force will be short 9 million college-educated workers, including 3 million associate degree holders. This shortage of skilled workers is likely to increase as baby boomers begin to retire. We must prepare to educate adult workers who have only a high school diploma, about 26.3%, to re-educate those adult workers who have some, but not all of a degree, a high school, or not all of a degree, and that's at about 23% in Minnesota, and or retain and re-educate adult workers who want or must prepare for a different job. LILAs are a great way to encourage all workers to learn new skills and be a vital part of our workforce. And with that, I'll let Una finish.
Thank you. And can you tell us your name again for the tape?
Una Choi. Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, impacting lives since 2001, lifelong learning accounts are mutually advantageous benefits viable to both employees and employers. These individualized, portable accounts render a wider range in the workforce and provide opportunities to those yet to exercise their full potential. In distributing tax credits to participating industries, LILAs contrive a cycle in which the employees and employers cater to their own incentives. LILAs are unique in that they stay with the employees, not the employers, and offer versatile training and education possibilities. Targeting low-income workers and industries with projected high occupational opening and industry growth, these accounts can also be used as additives or supplements to existing funds. Employees are provided with a chance to further their careers and lives, while employers find recruits with higher skill levels that capitalize their businesses. LILAs can alleviate training costs for both employees and employers, while in turn the community benefits from an overhaul, heightened stimulation of the economy, and an expanded canvas for change. In bridging the needs of both sides, spawns a collaborative workforce that is reciprocally adhesive to enhancement and clients. These efforts issue not only monetary profits, but also promotions and education, and they divulge the causes of unemployment and static careers, a lack of opportunity. Now workers can shift the routes to an ameliorative position in life, eventually education acting as a grant towards independence from future government aids. LILA broadens the field of education to include adults as public priorities. Individuals and employers invest in themselves for future productivity. LILA is a collective effort, harmonizing the workings and realities of the workforce. Now, thank you for the opportunity to testify in this informational hearing. And understanding the current financial circumstances and the purely informational nature of this hearing, I look forward to this legislation being discussed and proceeding when funds become viable.
Thank you, Ms. Choi. Representative Norton, further comments?
I would just say, Madam Chair, that this bill did provide an opportunity for employer and employee participation for re-education, for education accounts. We have something similar for our young learners, the 529 accounts, and this mirrored really those opportunities. And just for future knowledge, there's plenty of opportunity to be flexible with these accounts. We can lower the tax credit, we can increase the tax credit, we can narrow who we allow to have a tax credit. So I think despite the particular verbiage you had in the bill this year, there's lots of room to expand or contract the amount of money that the state would be impacted in the future, and I'm more than willing to work with members of the tax committee in future years when we can consider this a little more seriously to get the right amount.
Thank you. It's quite very impressive. Very impressive. May I say you're a junior, is that correct? So the spring break, are you going to look at colleges anywhere?
I am not. This is her spring break. This is her spring break. This joy. Oh, my goodness.
Well, very impressive testimony. It's really nice to have you with us, and I, you know, you were a junior in high school to give that kind of testimony. Very, very impressive. Nice to have you there. And, you know, I think we're kind of stalling here, so maybe we'll see if someone can ask a question, because we'd like to get a picture of you, Ms. Choi. So, and we'll give you those pictures, and you'll be glad you had them. And you can use those on your college application. Rep. Senator
Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I did not catch her residency. Where is she living at right now?
I'm Randy Demmer's constituent.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Russell.
To the testifier, do you have any interest in moving to Representative Norton's district?
Just so you don't have to answer that.
Nice testimony. Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'd like to pay my compliments to the testifier. So you were exceptional, and we will look forward to seeing you here at some point in your future. But also, just as a co-author of this legislation, I would just want to thank Representative Norton for bringing it forward. I think my predecessor, Representative Paulson, Senator Paulson, was the original sponsor of this last year. And again, as we've heard in Education Policy Committee, where I sit, and others, that we're looking for alternative pathways for people to become teachers. And we know people now are having to change careers multiple times throughout their life. That is the reality of the economy we live in. And I think it really behooves us to look at policies. I understand the chair may have disagreement with that, but I do think it's something good to look at the tax code and other methods of encouraging people to really plan for their futures in a way that helps them bridge those career transitions. So my compliments to Representative.
Thank you, and Ms. Choi. I should tell you that Representative Paulson did not get this bill passed, but he did become a member of Congress. So I think he got what he wanted. Representative Norton.
And Madam Chair, I would like to just apologize to Representative Lou. She did participate once she was elected, and here at the legislature, she did participate in a conference call and has shown interest in this. And as most of you know, I like carrying bipartisan bills, and was thrilled to have her on board. And so I failed to mention her earlier, and I apologize for that. Representative Loon, thank you so much for being a part of it.
Thank you. Further discussion? Questions? Okay, well, thank you so much. We're really glad you're here. We're not going to lay anything over because we didn't actually move it, but again, nice to see you, and thank you for being here, Representative Martin, as well. Thank you. Representative Maury.
I just wanted to ask a question about the process that you were talking about, and I meant to ask it earlier.
Sure.
I apologize. For our members' understanding, when we talk about bringing a bill that maybe shows a cost on the sheets for the state, if the member finds a cut in some agency that maybe isn't aligned with revenue, but it shows a cut and their bill evens out that way, is that also a way that they could get their bill heard, or is it just a matter of if they increase the tax to offset a reduction? I'm just trying to understand the interlocking between potential cuts that might be out there.
Yeah, I think that would work because within the tax area, I mean, certainly we heard my bill that we're going to take testimony on here later today, and I cut all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
And that raised revenue. And then I used that money and spent it on low-income tax cuts and Section 179 and single sales apportionment. So that certainly, there's certainly ways for members to do it who don't want to be for tax increases. But they just have to get a little creative. And if the committee ends up having a big promise, I mean, we're in April now, and we've been following this for January, February, and March. I can say in the last 2 years, we broke a record. We had interns look at how many bills had been heard in taxes over the last, 20 years. In the last 2 years, we broke a record. We heard, 300 and something. We heard every idea everybody had, and it was painful, as everyone will recall. Stop hearing bills. So this year, we actually really haven't heard that many because, in general, most members in both parties get it. I mean, we have a deficit, so they're really not introducing that many that cost that much. But I'm sure Mr. Michael and others will help members on either side of the aisle figure out how to get something here that way. I mean, I myself did it, and there's been a few others that did it. A lot of people's ideas that have put in bills that cost money were in the governor's bill, and we spent 6 days on that. So those have been covered, I think, pretty thoroughly. So that's a lot of the bills that get it. Representative Brett.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure our members were clear, because I think that is a a strong potential coming from our side in terms of how to get some of the bills paid for in a fair way. But, Madam Chair, I just will tell you I appreciate your willingness to hear a number of bills, and I also appreciate your new willingness not to hear some, too. Last year, I think we heard three or four bills that might have had the exact same language with different authors, and, you know, repetition this year is something that we probably don't need. So I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. Representative Weedling and Representative Defect.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to kind of be sure that I'm clear on what was just said, because I thought I heard Representative Broad asking about if she could find a cut in an agency somewhere, and I thought I heard the Chair talking about if you can find a cut in the tax bill. And I just want to be really clear, because I hope that we're not talking about, you know, do some spending in the tax bill and then go cut something in Health and Human Services that somebody didn't already think of cutting. So if you could just clear that up for me.
Yeah, I think it did. Representative Weaving, that it needs to be in the tax there, because this target is contained within the tax committee. But there's $11 billion in tax expenditures in the state budget. So people can just look around, and that $11 billion, you know, $11 billion of the biennium comes through tax expenditures. So there's a lot of room to move for folks who are looking for ways to fund their projects. But I think we can't jump off and cut it out of Health and Human, because this committee has no authority to determine the Health and Human Services committee budget or the higher ed budget or whatever. So those targets have been set, and we have to work within the constraints. But we have a lot of latitude. You know, folks know we're to a lot of members here, $1.5 billion is massive. But again, tax expenditures are $11 billion over the biennium. Representative Dietrich and Abroad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to touch on the point that Representative Weedling brought up, and that was taking from another department to help pay for the tax bill. The other thing, too, is that, and I don't expect an answer today, but I just want to throw this out here, is re-spending the same cut over and over and over again just to get bills heard. So I just think that could get pretty cumbersome and not very productive in the end result. Thank you.
Thank you. That is a point well taken. And we do have an agency we can cut. They're sitting out there. It's called the Department of Revenue. So you can cut them, too. So I guess actually most of their accounts are in Representative Kahn's committee, so we have to be careful. Representative Downey, did you have a question? No?
Or is it no, I was...
Okay, Representative Broad.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
You're making a matter of
action. So, I appreciate the clarification. But Madam Chair, just one last thing. You know, the targets are maximum expenditure, so there's nothing that says that we couldn't go underneath them in whatever area. So, I mean, in terms of whether we decide to try to cut something out of one agency or another, I understand how we can't increase the target for taxes, but there's nothing that says we can't go below.
That's certainly true. Yes, and, you know, members, it's not to be gotcha in a partisan way here. It's really focusing in a limited amount of time, from January to May, to get people on the task. Now, if you're not going to vote for that tax increase, we get it. And I think we know that there's a lot of people aren't going to vote for it, but in the end, this committee has been assigned a $1.5 billion target, and it's just been as difficult as it's been for both sides. They all hear this message. You know, if you have to raise 1.5 and then you're passing 5 million and 10 million and 20 million and 80 million in spending, you're just adding that all to the target. So the amount of tax burden you're going to place on Minnesotans just gets higher. So to me, it seems that's easier math, and I think that, you know, often the more conservative members, I think, are, you know, get this, you know, government's too big, right? So shrink government, and so don't put in bills that keep costing money. Democrats are getting at this year, too. So all these items that cost money, they're just spending initiatives, and they're good ideas, but they all cost money, and they're growing the government. They're not shrinking the government. So it just seems better discipline to not spend hours and hours and hours on new spending projects. So, I mean, even I noticed with the governor, he had a lot less spending initiatives this year. He had them, but he had a lot less than he usually does. For example, he didn't expand Job Z, which I thought he would, and he did, because there's a deficit. Representative Rosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to make sure I understand how the targets work for the tax committee in my first year on it. Is it correct that when this committee raises revenue, our target gets lower? In other words, the target for this committee is negative $1.5 billion. Is that correct? Or I've always struggled with this, because the tax committee is different than every other finance committee.
I know Rep. Mulder is waiting. We're going to ask Ms. Templin to come to the table anyhow, just to get this answered, because it's very important. Ms. Templin, I don't know if you heard Rep. Garofalo's question. And Rep. Garofalo is a new member of the tax committee. This is a very important question that people are confused, because there's only one committee in the legislature that is both a revenue committee and a finance committee, and this is it. Every other committee is a finance committee. We are a revenue committee. We're a finance committee, too. We spend on the expenditure side, we raise. So it's very confusing. People read the spreadsheets backwards. I know I've asked Ms. Templin when she addresses us, and we all want to get in the habit of seeing this, that when we look at spreadsheets, to really read, you know, how numbers are either in parentheses or not, and what that means, because people read them backwards. They'll think a negative is a positive. So, Ms. Templin, can you just kind of help people really simply understand the question that Representative Garofalo is asking?
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Analysis. For the record, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, in the budget resolution, I believe for the tax committee, you see a revenue or a target for the tax committee, and for revenues raised, you see for the fiscal 10 and 11 biennium a negative $1.5 billion. And in the budget resolution, that negative is viewed as savings, so that when we translate that to the tax committee side, that is $1.5 billion in additional revenue that the tax committee needs to generate on the bottom line for the fiscal 10 and 11 biennium. And also for the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium, there is, well, that's not in the budget resolution, but there are numbers out there as well for the amount that the tax committee needs to raise, of $2.9.
Ms. Templin, can I just add before I go back to Rep. Garofalo, can you also explain to members, because the division report has now been passed out of property tax committee, and there is targets to be met within that too, and how that works, how the tails work, and how the division report comes in to join up with the $1.5 billion. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, I don't have that spreadsheet in front of me, but I believe that the division had a target of a reduction of $250 million in 10 and 11, and that reduction of $250 million has been added to the $1.5 billion that the tax committee needs to raise, for a total of $1.7 billion in revenue that the committee has for a target for fiscal 10 and 11.
Okay, so just to clarify on that, just everyone gets that. So Representative Markworth's committee just passed the bill, and they had to shrink government by $250 million, and they met their target. That becomes part of our target for a grand total of $1.75. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I really do appreciate your indulgence in this, because this is my first year on the committee, as I mentioned. So just so I understand how, for the tax committee, this works, with a negative $1.5 billion target, if hypothetically an amendment were offered to raise additional revenue for $100 million, that would go from $1.5 billion to $1.6 billion, a larger negative number, a lower number, which would be acceptable. However, if we were to propose a tax cut of $100 million, that would go to a smaller negative number, or $1.4 billion, which would, making a comparison here, be like trying to blow a spending cap in one of the other targets, and would not be allowed under the budget resolution, but additional revenue raisers making the numbers go lower would be allowed. Am I stating this correctly?
Ms. Templin, we'll let the nonpartisan people confirm instead of me. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, correct. If it nets out, then yes. Then.
And Madam Chair, my last question.
Yes, Representative Garofalo. This is important, though, because it's hard for people to get their heads around it. I always remember Representative Abrams and Representative Krenke trying to get everyone to understand that when you cut something, you're doing spending, and people always mock that on the floor. I understand that, but that is exactly how it's playing out on the spreadsheet. Representative Garofalo.
So, and again, that same logic is that in the tax committee, if we are cutting an expenditure, that is the same thing as raising revenue from a target perspective. And in addition, if you propose more spending, it would be the same as cutting taxes, again, from the purpose, not from a policy standpoint, but from the budget resolution perspective. That's how I should understand it.
I think that's fair. Does anyone want to disagree with that in this room? I think that's both of the fiscal analysts are nodding yes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I appreciate
it. Thank you. And it's important going forward. It's just, you know, it is hard, and we're getting to the ugly time, so it's important we just keep kind of thinking about it.
I feel better. Representative David just told me he didn't understand a thing I just said.
Garoppolo, you absolutely got it, and it's the hardest thing because all the other committees just spend money. You just spend money, or in a deficit, they cut, and we have to do both. So, thank you. Appreciate it. Trustee Mallory, you ready to talk to us about Jojo?
Madam Chair, this is the strangest discussion of one of my bills in 13 years, except for one time in committee. It was in Health and Human Services. I had a bill for funding Southeast Asian agencies to train immigrants in occupational English, and the first 20 minutes was a discussion of abortion, so which was somewhat the Southeast Asians with me did not quite understand that, but so this is only the second strangest bill I've had. And Representative Davis, I don't have any of those fancy props like in the other committee. Madam Chair, it's an explanation. I could never get an explanation of my bill on extending the sheriff's foreclosure sale 5 months and shortening the redemption by 1 month. So I did it with him and to one person in the office, and they actually understood it. So I did it in committee, and everybody understood it the first time. Until then, they just stared at me. Madam Chair, I'll move 1664. And I think this will take about 1/20th as long as the free.
You have an amendment, right?
Yes, Madam Chair. I've got the A1 amendment.
So, Representative Mallory will the H1664 A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, this came to me from a constituent, and then several constituents probably that constituent contacted that we knew. And he said, why is it when I sell a car or buy a used car, I have to pay a sales tax and not when I buy a boat? And he had just bought a boat and could not understand that. So checking into it, you do have to upon sale of an auto, but not upon a boat or a snowmobile or an ATV. And in actuality, if we were going to exempt one thing, I think we should exempt the car rather than the others, because the car is an absolute necessity, and it seems that we've got it mixed up, but I think the best way to do it is not exempting the car, but to tax the others. And the revenue note is only on, it comes to about four and a half for the biennium, but that's just on the watercraft. And so that's the whole explanation of the bill and the fiscal note. I mean, the revenue.
Okay, thank you. There are questions from committee members. I think this one's pretty clear. Representative Davis, yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Mueller, would there be exclusions for sales to family members? Would that follow how you do an auto?
You mean like we do on cars?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Mallory or Ms. Dalton, do you want to?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, this does not have an exclusion if you are doing a transfer, but it does require a bill of sale. I'm not sure that, you know, if you're just changing the license, that necessarily. I would have to look into it further and see if you would need to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mallory, are you open to thinking about that a little bit?
Madam Chair, I would never vote to anyone.
Okay. Is there any public testimony on this bill? Any further questions? If not, we're going to lay over this bill for possible inclusion on this tax bill. Thank you. Now, that early discussion just helped you.
I think I put everybody.
Thank you, Representative Mallory. We're going to hear further public testimony on a bill I have before the committee, House File 1782. If there's anybody who would like to speak for or against this bill, please come forward. In the meantime, I don't know if Representative Murphy has had time to read the minutes of what day? April 1st. Representative Murphy moves the minutes of April 1st, the Second Amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those say nay. Motion carries.
No.
Okay. So, this is an April Fool's. No.
Yes. This is April Fool's.
Mr. Heffy, welcome to the committee. And you want to tell us what you think of House Bill 1782?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do.
Welcome. And I want to hear it.
For the record, my name is Tom Heffy. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And maybe I'll proceed, Madam Chair, if that's okay. First talk about some of the positive elements of the bill and then some of the issues that we find problematic. And I should also just state that on balance, the Minnesota Chamber cannot support this legislation at this time, but having said that, there really are some positive elements in the legislation. First, accelerating sales-only apportionment or single-sale factor apportionment, that's an issue that our members have been interested in and worked on for a number of years that will benefit companies that have large investments of property and payroll in the state and sell nationally, and it really is kind of a competitive issue for our members. That many other states are moving in this direction or have already gone to single-sale factor apportionment. And the real benefit is to get there before others do. So accelerating that is certainly a positive element of this bill. As is conforming to the Section 179 expensing, I think I've mentioned that in previous testimony, so I won't go into more detail there, but that's certainly a provision that small businesses support. Repealing the AMT. Not a whole lot of conversation happens about that provision, but it's also important. And then our members, small companies that are organized as S-Corps, limited liability companies, partnerships, sole proprietors, will obviously benefit from the personal income tax rate reductions that are found in your legislation. They flow their business income through their personal return, and that would definitely be a plus for them. With that, I'll turn to some of the problematic provisions, and you've probably heard all this before last year and maybe in years previous to that, but I'll start with the foreign royalty deduction. The bill eliminates the foreign royalty deduction, and the purpose of that deduction is to incent companies to develop technology and intellectual property here in Minnesota and then license it to other companies, to foreign companies. In our view, foreign royalties that are generated in those types of transactions are really only made possible by the hundreds of millions of dollars of research and development investment made in the U.S. and in Minnesota. So corporations create high-paying jobs locally and generate foreign royalties by, again, licensing that technology to foreign companies. Changing the deductibility of foreign royalties, we think, could jeopardize this domestic R&D investment. Similarly, the repeal of the R&D credit also will have a negative impact, we think, on R&D investment in the state. 40 states, at last count, have some sort of R&D credit, many of which are much more generous than Minnesota's. We think the foreign royalty deduction and the R&D credit work in concert. They really do help companies that have large research facilities live with a 9.8 statutory corporate income tax rate. So eliminating those two provisions, again, we think will hurt the R&D functions of many companies and the jobs that go with those. With respect to foreign operating corporations, I've talked many years about that. We continue to believe that foreign operating corporation structure is an important addition to Minnesota's tax system. Again, the purpose of FOCs was to place U.S. Companies operating outside the U.S. on an equal footing with foreign competitors, and that is, I think, still an important policy goal, especially since in the last legislative session some legislation passed to change the rules with respect to more passive income of foreign operating corporations. Now the definition of an FOC requires 80% of the income to be believed to be foreign operating or foreign operating income. So we do think eliminating the FOC deduction goes backwards on the policy decision of, I think, like 1988, where they did want to create this equal footing between corporate structures and foreign operations. Sections 4 and 5 of the bill, the definition of domestic corporation and the tax haven legislation, we also have some significant concerns about it. The definition of domestic corporation is expanded in three ways. One, it adds corporations which are incorporated in a tax haven country, and there's a long list of countries that are considered a tax haven country. But maybe more importantly and troubling, just even doing business in a tax haven country is also causes you to become a domestic corporation. And then finally, if you have an apportionment percentage of 20% or more, you are also a domestic corporation for the purposes of Minnesota tax. That's a significant expansion of what a domestic corporation is. It looks to me that we're really trying to broaden it out to a worldwide basis, a worldwide combined reporting without maybe explicitly saying so. And if I can focus on the tax haven provisions for just a minute, there are several reasons why we have issues with that. First, in our view, companies aren't operating in tax haven, the list of quote-unquote tax haven countries to shield U.S. income because they really can't shift U.S. source income to other countries without facing some IRS tax consequences. Second, these provisions would clearly tax income from foreign operations, resulting in added complexity in Minnesota, such as things like currency translation, translations of profits and losses, and valuing foreign property. Third, there's really an extremely low nexus threshold here. It assumes the fact that even if you're just doing business in one of the countries listed in at least Section 5, it should pay Minnesota tax or file a Minnesota return. So if a German consumer products company sells a good in Luxembourg, it would then have, if it has no physical presence in Minnesota, it would have to file a Minnesota return. It is doing business in one of its labeled tax haven countries and would be subject then to Minnesota tax. I don't know how that is fair and how the Department of Revenue will know that transaction took place. So I think before we go down the tax haven route, we should consider these types of questions pretty seriously. Fourth, the list of countries deemed to be tax havens is quite expansive. And the last I checked, there are currently only three countries on the OECD's uncooperative tax haven list. And this legislation suggests there are 28 countries that the mere fact that a company does business there would cause someone to file a Minnesota return. So at least the OECD has done a lot of work on trying to figure out which countries have cooperative tax agreements with the rest of the OECD. Right now there are only three countries on that list. Fifth, it gives the commissioner a very broad authority to designate a country as a tax haven if that country has a nominal tax rate and the commissioner believes that the federal government would have difficulty gathering tax information from them. Many believe that this authority could interfere with Congress's right to regulate commerce with foreign nations. The Supreme Court has struck down other state statutes that frustrated Congress's ability to speak with, as they say, with one voice in its foreign dealings. So we have some concerns about that as well. Two other provisions that I'll raise. One, the eliminating the deductibility of at least half of development subsidies. Also will make it more difficult and most likely more expensive to create new developments within Minnesota. I think the panel, at the last hearing, some of the developers talked about this in great length, so I won't go into detail there, but it does, to us, seem like it will raise the cost of development in Minnesota and could hurt the ability of the state to develop its, create more jobs and economic development. And then finally, the state property tax provision in the bill, it adds airport property to the statewide property tax. And the way it does that, I think we should go back and think about what my understanding was the rationale of the 2001 property tax reform with respect to airport property. And if my recollection is correct, those properties were exempt from the statewide property tax. Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is not within a school district. And the theory back in 2001 was, we're going to take some properties off of school operating referenda levies, and in place we would subject them to the statewide property tax. That never happened for commercial industrial property, but it did happen for cabins and resorts. But since MSP was not within a school district, it was would not receive any benefit if the state would have gone down the route of exempting commercial industrial property from operating referenda levies. And my understanding is Holman Field also had a special carve-out, but it was not subject to operating levies. So the decision then was not to subject those types of properties to the statewide property tax. So it certainly would backtrack on at least my recollection of the 2001 reforms. And the way the bill is worded, I believe, would also increase the tax rate on all other properties for the statewide property, all the commercial, industrial, and utility properties for the statewide property tax, and that troubles us as well. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Mueller, then Mark Bartlett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hessen, going way back here, or at the FOP, and I haven't looked at this for a while, so I think track up what we have closed and what we have not closed. But it didn't seem like what you were explaining really got at some of the things that were going on, such as, I believe, a big certain savings and loan that was located here put its logo into an FOC or something like that and then rendered it back to each location here. What you were saying sounded, you know, maybe there's some justification, but I'm describing that actually happened. Certainly does not fit your explanation of why we shouldn't be doing it.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, last year's change, I think, used the term active foreign business income. And the example you provide would be passive income, so that would not qualify for the 80% exclusion of the FOC. It would actually be an entity that just did that, put a trademark in a an FOC, would not be able to deduct that income because of the changes that were adopted last session.
Thank you very much,
Madam Chair. Mr. Hesse, you had mentioned right away that you said on balance you could not support this bill. So if we've got scales here, and you said you liked the Section 179, you said you liked the lower overall marginal rates, then you said you liked the single sales factor. Okay, so here we are. And now we're adding back on foreign royalties, the repeal of the R&D, the FOCs, the domestic, and so forth. What things could we take off of here to, on balance, get you to like the bill? Because, of course, we have to make decisions here, and we don't always get everything we want. So would all seven things have to be eliminated before it would balance? Or are there some, you know, if we took the foreign royalties, would that really make it come clear? What are of the seven things you mentioned that are weighting this thing down now, what could we take off of there to, on balance, you could support that?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, when you look at the revenue estimate for the bill, there's a significant corporate tax increase, even despite the positive elements. So I think all seven, if it was seven, of the concerns that I raised, in our view, have to be addressed. I don't think our members are expecting any reduction in the bottom two personal income tax rates, given the budget situation here. Obviously, if it's something that's moving forward, they gladly accept that. But I don't think they are certainly expecting a personal income tax reduction during a session like this. So I just want to focus on the provisions, the seven provisions I think will have certainly negative consequences for a wide variety of businesses in this state. I'm not sure we can tip the balance in the bill's favor without addressing all of them.
Mr. Hesse, okay, so I'm looking at the revenue estimate. So on that, looks like the negative for the business world is $58 million. You know, we have a $6.4 billion deficit, so I know everybody's trying to find a way, and Mr. Hesse, people to know, I work really well with Mr. Hesse, and I'm not, this isn't about him. Everybody is finding a way to not get caught, you know, paying for the deficit, but, you know, the idea that everyone's going to have to give a little, I mean, 58 is pretty tiny. And a $6.4 billion deficit, the benefits are huge. And then Representative Markowitz, I don't know if you know this, he did not tax commercial industrial at all and kept them completely harmless while local government and county and all these other things are going to take a hit. So, you know, I just would really encourage you, because you have a very broad and diverse and very informed and very helpful constituency you represent, to really help folks get some scale of what the issues are here. So, you know, I think in the end, people know that all the new spending initiatives that people are proposing probably won't happen. So, and you've been, I think, very, you know, you've been very realistic about that too. And so getting to what really will happen in the final solution, you know, I don't think anyone's going to get out of the, you know, the game here without a little dust up. But I do, you know, so I certainly hear some of those, you know, I hear you. I just want to tell you that some of them are much more, I think, and from a policy perspective, you should be opposing me on them. Others, I think, are really hard to justify. I mean, you know, for example, the airport not paying taxes. I mean, you know, that helps Northwest Airlines, and, you know, they're not going to be headquartered here anymore. So, you know, we have a tough time ahead of us, and it's hard to give out preferential tax treatment to people anymore. So, you know, I want to tell you I really appreciate that you've been willing to work with me to think this through, and I know that you have to, you know, fight, hold your ground here, and I think you're really doing well in the House. That's what I'm saying. I think you're doing really well in the House so far. And it may not feel like it to you, but in the end, you know, there's going to have to be some give and take. So I do appreciate the willingness to keep talking. Mr. Hesse, any other comments to the committee?
Madam Chair, for the record, I thanked Representative Mark Hort during my testimony in front of his committee. I do recognize that that's you know, certainly a benefit to us to not have a provision on the broader statewide property tax in the division report. So, again, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Stemmer.
You know, Madam Chair, but I guess my only thoughts, Madam Chair, is as we go forward, sometimes a savings or not a savings, an apparent savings to the state could end up being a bigger loss to the state in the other side of things, because sometimes these, and I don't, you know, we can go through all of these different things here with the businesses, but it's about job creation, Madam Chair. It's about job creation in the private sector, and as we increase costs to the private sector, there will be loss of jobs because it's difficult out there, and we have to keep that in mind also as we look at how much can we get out of the private sector. That's my thought.
Thank you. And the job creation parts are in the bill. That major, keeping Minnesota jobs and helping new jobs come to Minnesota in the bill through single sales apportionment and Section 179, and I appreciate that you brought that forward. So it's a mixed bag. I mean, no doubt about it. All these sectors will be. Further on this piece, Representative Broadden is further testifying. Representative Broadden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question might be for Mr. Michael. As I look at the language on 4.13, I'm trying to understand, related to the tax havens, what open and apparent actually would mean related to the tax regimes in these areas. I don't know if that's a legal standard or if it's just words.
Mr. Michael, notice Representative Broad asked the right person. He didn't ask the author of the bill.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, with your respect.
Yes. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, I don't, in terms of whether it's a legal standard, I don't think it's something that's been litigated, if that's what you're asking. This legislation was modeled after legislation that's part of Montana law. Montana has a statute like this, and a federal bill that was proposed by Senators Levin and Coleman, and most of this language is lifted from the combination of the Montana law and the Levin-Coleman bill in the last session of Congress. And it also, I think, follows on some work that's been done by the OECD with regard to tax havens and the, you know, the difficulties that developed countries with sort of regular tax systems have with businesses that locate operations in these tax havens, or don't, not much operations at all, but nevertheless shift substantial income to them. If you actually look at the statistics that have been put together, you'll see that over like the last decade or so, the income, corporate income of these multinational companies, not just U.S. multinationals, but foreign multinationals that's located in these tax havens, is grown, you know, disproportionately to total income, which has caused some people concern, which is why they're, you know, nationally people are looking at ways to sort of minimize that tax minimization practice that's been going on.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Michael, I appreciate the description. I'm just trying to understand how that those words actually do anything. You know, I think some could argue that there's parts of our tax regime or system that are not transparent or apparent. And so as we move forward, I guess I want to look at that language a little bit. I think Mr. Hesse makes a good case related to some of those things. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Further testimony for or against this bill? Welcome.
My name is Jim Field. I represent the private schools, 530 private schools in the state. I'm president of the Minnesota Independent School Forum, and for 14 years I've chaired the non-public ed council for the state. There's two sections, section 29 and section 8, that we'd like to see deleted from this bill. Section 29 deals with Minnesota K-12 education credit, Minnesota statute 290.0674, affecting the tax year 209, enacting the this was enacted in 1997. This program provides a valuable source of funds to lower income families with children in both public and non-public schools. It enables parents to obtain help in meeting educational expenses. Note that tuition expenses do not qualify. Qualifying expenses are limited to 75% of cost of service. That was changed about 4 years ago. And instructional materials, education services, because of this credit, may play an important role in reducing the learning gap. I'd like to remind the state that Minnesota has the largest achievement gap in the country. We're number 50. Educational services sought by parents to meet their children's unique needs may provide vital help that will change in the course of someone's life, our children. The Section 8 eliminates the subtraction, which is a credit, for educational expenses. Minnesota Statute 290.01, Subdivision 19B3, effective for tax year 209. For many years, this provision has helped families with children in both public and private schools with costs related to K-12 education. As with tax credit, qualifying expenses are limited to specific items, though the provision does allow subtraction for tuition. I'm sorry, I'm talking about the deduction here. Mm-hmm. I get mixed up.
We all get mixed up.
In this difficult economic time, this may be even of greater importance to families. And this language that's in the bill really does hurt our low-income families in the state. What we'd like to say is that for the private school part of this, it's going to cause the low-income families to transfer to the public school. Won't cause all of them, but if you're a family and you don't get that credit or deduction, you just aren't going to be able to afford the tuition And sometimes it doesn't take much for these families that are suffering to take them over the edge on tuition. Every student that transfers from a non-public school to a public school costs the state probably around $12,000 a kid. So if 1,000 students transfer out of the 85,000 that go to private schools, that's $12 million. And I'd like the committee to understand that this law doesn't affect just taxes, it does affect, you know, our educational system in Minnesota. So I appreciate the hard work you people are doing. I know you have to start somewhere, and it's really been a lot of work for everybody, so we're with you on that. We just feel this is not good. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pete Noll, Minnesota Catholic Conference Education Director. I'm going to concur with much of what Mr. Field said, particularly the last part about the hard work that you have in front of you and the degree of work that you've already put in on this topic, and also like to commend the Chair on the preponderance of the bill, actually. We find ourselves in agreement with much of the bill, except for the basic elimination of the education tax credit and deduction components of the bill. I'd like to add to that that this, particularly the subtraction part, is probably the longest standing parental choice legislation in the country, dating back to 1995. It's received a lot of a lot of parents have availed themselves of this. I think last fiscal year there were close to 300,000 taxpayers who benefited from this, which ought to say to all of us that people appreciate this. And so why would we tamper with something that seems to be working? This is the real conundrum, I think, and kind of perplexing to us as to why we would tamper with something that obviously a lot of people are participating in benefiting from. It's targeting specifically educational benefits so that parents are empowered to be able to use that in the way that they deem can best be used to help the education of their child. And I don't know why we would want to interfere with that ability for them to do that. And we have similar concerns about the possibility of parents needing to move from a school that really costs the state very little money in the non-public sector to a private or a public school where now we're going to have to add to the other side of the ledger. We're going to have to add in or provide the foundation aid for those children. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you about this important issue, and thank you for your hard work.
Thank you for your testimony. And I just want to say, you know, I know when people look at pieces in isolation, it's rough, and I appreciate that you tried to look in total as well. But I think what folks may not understand about what's going on in this bill is it's sort of a matrix of the dependent child care credit going away, the K-12 credit going away, and instead being replaced with this new Family Knows Best credit. So our early analysis appears that, in fact, low-income Minnesotans are mostly going to be winners overall. And so you've got sort of this issue where there's these expenditures going on that's not transparent and clear, you know, competing in the finance world. It's back happening in the tax code. And, you know, taxpayers don't even understand all this stuff. So if you look at just taking that away and then just taking it away, I mean, I think that would be really dramatic. But it's being replaced with this new credit, which is means tested and then allows families to either have it go for public or private school, as you know, it's for both, and or for buying groceries or for whatever. It's trying to keep government silent on how low-income families should use their limited resources. And so in a way, it's like the Working Family Credit, which I know your organizations have supported, and the Earned Income Tax Credit, and then, of course, coupled with lower burdens on the lower brackets. We have something in it that the committee has, and I didn't go through it today, but we're going to get it out later, because it isn't in color, so it's very hard to read. But the net effect of this bill is really a dramatic shift from
folks at the lower end of the spectrum getting an income, getting assistance, and those who are the wealthiest Minnesotans giving some stuff up because we just can't afford it in this current deficit. And they're in an attempt to get rid of things that really don't work and other things that are maybe real discretionary and telling people what to do to get the benefit and instead opening it up so families can make choices. And so I know it's hard to hear it as an individual group, but on net, the bill is a dramatic improvement for Minnesotans of lower means. And it does take away from those who are best off. There's no question about that. And I know you've got that, you're supporting that as well, because the K-12 credit isn't for wealthy Minnesotans either. So I understand that, and you know, we'll continue to have the discussion, but it's really the deficit that I think is pushing me and others on both sides of the aisle to say, what can we stop doing? How can we shrink government rather than just raising taxes? And so it's kind of a conundrum, as you stated. So I really do appreciate the testimony. I know it's difficult. Questions to either of these testifiers on this sort of bucket of issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that you're both here. I know that you feel strongly about this program, and I agree with you. When you have 300,000 individuals using something that advantages and keeps them empowered to control their own choices, I think that's a very good thing. Madam Chair, I was going to move to pull these provisions, but in deference to not trying to unbalance your bill, I won't do that. But I do think that sometimes we outthink ourselves, and when we have a program that's working well, that is working based on the mission that it was put in place for, we ought to think very carefully, and I know, Madam Chair, that you are thinking very carefully. I think about all the parents out there who are paying tuition to send their child to kindergarten. I remember doing that long, long, long time ago, too long ago, in fact. The other concern I have, Madam Chair, is that when you change something for tax year 2009, parents made decisions about where they're going to send their child to school or where they're getting their assistance or whether they're getting that additional tutoring assistance. They made those decisions already. And so to change the program midstream, I think, is going to be very difficult for some of them to manage and could be considered a tax increase on a number of them. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate how these all things intertwine, and I'll be looking at those things. But I did want to thank you both for coming forward today.
Thank you. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Further testifiers for or against this bill? Welcome. So we have many testifiers left. You can people raise hands if you want to say something, plus or minus. 1, 2, 3. Plus the 2 at the table. Is that all? 3 plus 2 at the table. Okay. That's not bad. Does anybody want to say anything nice? I really do appreciate, though, that most people really understand, you know, this is all a bunch of bad choices. I mean, no one's kidding anybody around here. We're not going to get out of this deficit without a lot of people feeling a lot of pain, and that happens whether you cut stuff from people or you raise their taxes. Both bad options. So appreciate that people understand the seriousness of the problem. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. And Madam Chair, I did attend your press conference where you had the waterfall and lake analogy, and I really appreciated that. I thought it was a really good presentation of just kind of how complicated the tax system is in this state and where things end up. For the record, though, we would like, the League of Minnesota Cities would like to be on record really with 3 points in this bill. The first, I think, Tanya Orr is going to comment on as well, and that's Section 7 dealing with state and local government bonds. This would, in our opinion, maybe make those bonds less attractive to those folks who choose to invest in these and end up costing those folks more. In this economy, frankly, we have concerns about that as local governments move ahead with projects locally and those related to the federal stimulus package. Secondly, the TIF provisions that I believe you've heard on from the panel the last time around, we would echo those comments. I do appreciate your limiting this somewhat to, I think, economic development and redevelopment districts. If you're able to, going down the road, take redevelopment districts out of that equation as well, that would be even better in our opinion. We have lots of cities across the state that are just looking at redevelopment needs more and more in these years. And finally, I'll speak up for Job B. It's not an easy thing to do here, but not speaking for those businesses necessarily that get Job B, but for those local governments who have used the program and are still hoping to see more miracles from the program,
The league has a policy asking that there be no more changes or restrictions made to this program, so I just wanted to voice that for the record.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and I would like to just comment about Section 7. As you probably know, the Housing Finance Agency is one of the largest issuers of tax-exempt bonds in the state. We use the proceeds of those bonds to purchase mortgages for first-time homebuyers who are low and moderate income. Last year, we served nearly 2,700 first-time homebuyers who had a median income of $40,000. So we do serve the low and moderate income families in Minnesota who are trying to get into homeownership. We think that Section 7 will result in the cost of the bonds that we issue going up, which means that that will translate into a higher mortgage rate for the people that we're trying to serve. And we also think that this will, right now there's a preference essentially for Minnesota bonds if you're a taxpayer, and the rate is the same for Minnesota bonds and someplace else, you'll buy Minnesota bonds because there's the income that you earn is not taxable. That preference will go away, and that will mean that people will just look for the highest yielding bonds. I'd like to point out one other thing, and that is that last year the legislature appropriated debt service for nonprofit housing bonds for supportive housing for long-term homeless people. And you set an annual cap on the amount of debt service that would be paid. If we sell those bonds after July 1st of this year, it's possible that the assumptions that we used on a certain interest rate will not hold true, which would mean we would not be able to issue the full amount that was authorized. So we won't be able to provide as much of the long-term homeless housing as we had hoped. And I'd like to, one final thing. In a very quick cursory review of the revenue analysis, it looked to me like you accounted for the increased revenues, but I wondered about whether the additional cost to the state, particularly to the state, about if the bonds go, or the cost of issuing the bonds goes up, then the state is going to be paying more debt service on all the DL bonds, on the, you know, we would, and so did you take that into account? And that wasn't clear to me if that's a net revenue or not. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you. Thank you, Ms. Orr. And of course, that's the Department of Revenue does the revenue estimate. So if they want to answer Ms. Orr, they may, how they did the estimate on that particular provision. You know, and I should just say for members and for folks who are here, you know, we have a lot of members on both sides of the aisle who kind of want me to say the revenue estimates are wrong and sort of go at the department. And I mean, there are both parties here that just can't be right. And what I've done is just decided to not weigh into what they do and just take their number. Because in the end, things could go up or down a little, but in the end, it's can the House, Senate, and the Governor support something. But I know it's something we hear on both sides a lot, that we just have to go after the department because their numbers are bad. And I will admit, I'm one who's been reluctant to do that. I'd rather let them do their work independently from us. But Ms. Cadoon?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just respond to that one question. When I was looking at the revenue estimate as well, I did not see the offset or increased cost for potential debt service. I think quite so need to bring that to my research. To make sure that they took that into account. As you know, your bill had a lot of moving parts, very complicated to do the revenue estimate, so it's certainly possible that they may have overlooked that provision. If they did, I'll make sure that we bring that information and make it available.
Thank you, Ms. Cannon. Thank you, Ms. Orr, for raising that, so we'll get an answer to you on that. Further testifier, just have a couple left. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist representing, along with my partner, Ms. Sandvig, who's over by the doorway, Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley represents nearly 600 life science companies, including many locally headquartered medical device, pharmaceutical, and biotech companies, and the companies that support them. These companies range in size from small startups to major multinational organizations that devote their efforts to the research, development, and commercialization of the life sciences. In Minnesota, they provide 50,000 high-wage skilled jobs. We are here today to express our concerns in opposition to the elimination of the Research and Development Tax Credit in House File 1782. State economist Tom Stinson has noted in the past that the identification of new products and new processes and new ways of doing things has slumped significantly in Minnesota compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. And part of our underperformance economically is that we just haven't been investing enough in R&D compared to the rest of the country. R&D tax credits help boost the business climate since R&D jobs pay on average $70,000 per year. In addition, it's important to also understand that the device tech companies are not the only companies who benefit from these R&D operations in Minnesota. Much of the work of R&D requires specialized supports of suppliers and development partners. There are a whole host of small and medium-sized companies who participate and benefit from these operations. 32 other states have R&D tax credits and are making concerted efforts to increase their R&D tax credits and provide other incentives to attract expansions and investments to their states. A reduction in Minnesota's credits will make us a state, will make other states' jobs easier, and will decrease the incentives for Minnesota's knowledge-based industry to invent in job creation in Minnesota. If R&D facilities are established or expanded in other states, the spin-offs from those new companies will happen there and not here. A Harvard study recently noted that Medtronic alone is responsible for 156 other medical device companies in Minnesota. This is not just a large company issue. Growing mid-sized firms could be especially hurt. These companies, with revenue from $50 to $500 million and employing $50 to $500 people, are rapidly growing and tend to invest their profits in R&D and other growth activities that result in job creation. The R&D tax credit allows them to increase this investment, resulting in more jobs. Small companies that have no profits bank the R&D tax credit for when they achieve profitability. The result is that when they start earning money, they are able to reinvest more of those profits back to R&D growth. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the state is undergoing intense economic challenges. And Madam Chair, I just want to leave my testimony a little bit here and say that we understand the difficult job that you have in front of us. And I hold an optimism when I see Representative Lanning and read what's going on in his area of the state and the pitch that people have made. We send all of our thoughts and prayers out to the people of your area. But we see Minnesotans and people from all over pitching to fix those things. I would only be critical of the committee's work in one way, and that is just before I came to testify, Representative Gardner opened the door and let Representative Davids in, and I'm afraid of what that might result in. Madam Chair, we understand the difficulty that you and the members of this committee have. We want to work with you to try and help solve these problems. We believe strongly and have a number of companies that are highly committed to Minnesota and to growing jobs here. We want to work with you to try and keep the tax credit, and for that reason, we are in opposition to the elimination of the R&D tax credit. Madam Chair, if there are any questions that I can answer, I'd be happy to take them.
Okay, thank you. And I think there are none yet, but I would just say, you know, I appreciate that, the recognition of the task ahead. And I think the R&D credit is a perfect example of, it may not be that getting rid of all these things is the way to go in the end, but it certainly could, in my mind, a lot of these things need to be competing with all the other state spending. And because they are first taken out of the tax revenue stream before we even get to the fiscal debate, they're kind of always in and never examined. And I know there was a group that just recently, a five foundation group, and I'm not sure what it's called, the just public strategies maybe, they came out with a big study basically kind of taking this same approach that, you know, all these tax expenditures that are going on before the competition for the public good takes place really erode, you know, trust in the tax system. People don't understand why some people are winners or losers. I think one other side benefit of sort of having this debate about these items is a lot of people around here, and you're not one of them, assert that, you know, government doesn't do anything for them, or they're a business and government doesn't give them anything. They just create jobs and pay taxes and they don't get anything for that. And you're certainly not doing that. There's been a strong partnership with the companies that you're involved with, that we need a strong university and we need well-educated electorate and we need these things too, and to be successful businesses we need these things too. But I think all of these items have price tags, and they show legislators that this assertion that, you know, everybody, individuals and corporations, just pay taxes and they don't get anything, it's just not true. They're getting lots of things and they all cost millions and millions of dollars. And so putting it out there helps people realize, yeah, you have to make choices and it isn't free, and lots of businesses are getting lots of benefits from government. And so I think, you know, in the end, you know, the R&D credit item could be a grant. It could compete in the in an open way. But it's certainly something that, you know, you could argue isn't big enough to even be effective. And I think you've argued that in the past in committee, that it's probably so low it might not be working so well. And so maybe we should spend more on it. And that might be the right argument to have. I mean, maybe it should be up there fighting with other things. And I don't have the answers on that. I'm just trying to get people to, you know, recognize there's a lot of hidden spending going on in the tax code that really is not being brought forward. And sort of the initial response when people hear you have to raise money is to just think of which taxes to raise. There's other ways. And this bill itself shows to hit a $1.5 billion target, you know, you could raise a couple hundred million just by taking away stuff that people get. And if you're that person experiencing that, it's a personal tax increase to you. I get that. It's also everybody else is paying for it, and it's shrinking government. So I do think the path we're on is unsustainable, and I'm trying to get my colleagues on both sides of the aisle here, not just, you know, not just convince the minority. I want to convince the majority, too, that the budget trends working group show that the way we're going is not sustainable, and part of the way to get, you know, revenue is to stop having so much spending in the tax code. And it's difficult, and I know everybody doesn't want it to happen to them. So I appreciate that, you know, you understand that it's difficult, and, you know, I don't think the tax bill vote can be a fun vote, but I think, you know, it's good to keep having the debate and have everybody sort of compete and open for what all these things are. So I really do appreciate that.
Madam Chair, if I might just briefly, and I know
yes, please.
Many members are tired, but I just want to emphasize what you said. If I brought you Life Science Alley's legislative agenda today, you would see that at the top of the agenda we talk about the need for job creation through continuing to support both our K-12 and our higher education system. There is no doubt in our minds that having the people that come out of these schools that staff our companies are one of the big reasons why we have been successful in Minnesota. And we understand the need to spend those dollars wisely. We look at the project that the governor proposed a couple of years ago, and if you haven't seen some of the results of the genomics partnership between Mayo and the U, and as somebody who lobbied many years ago for the medical association, if someone had told me that the governor would be successful in getting those two institutions to work together, I would have laughed in their face. These are big things that are resulting in some fairly major changes, and if you ever want the opportunity, we would love to have you come over and see our annual meeting where we have thousands of people coming in to talk about the things that are going on. I have an optimism that these things are going to result in things that will eventually improve lives and save health care costs, and we hope to continue working with you and the committee members to make sure that happens here in Minnesota.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Bergman, who took a shot and found it, the group's called Bottom Line, or the study's called Bottom Line, and it is the Minnesota Community Foundation, the Bush Foundation, the Minneapolis Foundation, the, I can't read your writing, Northwest Area Foundation, maybe, and the St. Paul Foundation, who just completed the study. But I do think, you know, the truth of it that people don't want to hear is to keep all this stuff and all this spending, you either have to cut someone else or you got to raise taxes. And so now one of the things I'm trying to do is cut a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I think people need to come forward then and say, no, don't cut, raise taxes more, or cut somebody else. And I think that's the hard, the easy one is cut someone else. We get it. And all the fiscal chairs are cutting. All of them have minus targets. So they will be cutting. And so I'm hoping to get members here to see that one way to get to $1.5 billion is to stop doing everything, too, not just do the simple raise taxes. So appreciate the discussion. We're all in it together.
I'd like to see the study myself.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Ellers, please. Yeah.
I just had a question for Mr. Griffin. You know, and everybody recognizes the situation we're in, how bad it's going to be, how difficult it's going to be. But I'm just curious, you know, as someone who studies these issues, not just for us here in Minnesota, but around the country, around our region, I'm curious what you're seeing in some of the other areas that when it comes to this particular, maybe not the actual chapter and verse words, but this area of it. So the R&D credits, not particularly in Medical Alley, but as a whole around our area, but then also around the country.
And Madam Chair, Representative Zell, this is one of those areas that we talked about 2 years ago when we had the tax bill in front of us, and we brought you some examples. And I would say that, as I said then, we're not just competing with North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin here. We are competing nationally for these jobs, and there are just a few states that I would say are way out in front of the other states. And those are states like Massachusetts, the Triangle down in the Carolinas, what's going on in Rhode Island, what's going on in California. and our neighbors in Wisconsin and Ohio has picked up considerably. Ohio dedicated their entire tobacco settlement to those kinds of research projects. You've heard numerously what's going on in California. They have a 20% R&D tax credit in that state. We lost a major research facility to that state a couple of years ago from one of our big companies. And those are the kinds of things that anecdotally I can give you off the top of my head. But that is the tough issue as you try and examine it. You can't just compare us with what's going on next door because those jobs will move very easily someplace else. And they will go to the states where they're out there trying to make them off. And economic development has become, unfortunately, a competitive thing between states. I'm not sure that's the best way to do it. I'm fairly certain it's not the best way to do it, but it's the way it's being done, and we need to compete in that market.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ruff. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I think we have one more or two more. Two more. Come on up. Welcome.
Yeah, sure. Mark Haven with the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, and I'm going to take a little different tack in the couple minutes that I have here. We have a tendency to pontificate about tax policy principles a lot. Obviously, the issue of fairness has been a big theme in this bill, and frankly, for all tax discussions that are going on right now. Can I just offer a couple of thoughts on the fairness issues in this bill? First of all, there are two dimensions, obviously. The one that doesn't get much attention is the horizontal equity issue, which is treating equals equally, and you don't see that much in tax bills, and this one is loaded with it, and I think that deserves a lot of recognition. That's the type of thing where you don't want to have your filing status determined. Who wins and who loses. It's a much more efficient way to go about it, and it was a welcome thing to see. And clearly, those are it's the approach that deserves recognition. We can have all sorts of debates and discussions about the size of these sorts of things, but the strategy is definitely on track. With respect to progressivity, obviously, if progressivity is a goal, this is also the way to do it. There are two cautions I would throw into the debate with respect to progressivity in the tax system for the committee's consideration. The first one is that public finance people generally agree that progressivity gains are probably best left to the federal system to the extent you can, for the reason that it's easy to move out of state and not so easy to move out of the country. The second one, though, I think is perhaps even a little bit more relevant to especially what's going on with the budget debate right now. That's the accountability issues that are embedded in progressivity debates. And the example I would throw out there is the state of California. Many people would probably consider the tax system in California to be a form of tax nirvana. A very, very progressive income tax. And for a large majority of residents, an extremely low set of property taxes. When you look at their fiscal system right now and what they're going through, they've got a lot of problems. And the question you ask is, well, why? And there are many things that go into that. But one that you can see quickly when you sort of unpack what's going on in that state is a fundamental and potentially fatal disconnect between tax price and services being offered in the state. A lot of people for a long time have been insulated from the cost of government, and there are all these sort of thresholds that I'm not suggesting that Minnesota is about to cross that or something of that nature, but it's important to keep in mind. Payboard type initiatives pop up when tax price systems fail. Some PhD student is going to make his career demonstrating that, but I offer that as not only as part of this bill, but generally speaking, of the tax discussions that are going to be coming before you. So, for that,
appreciate it. Very insightful. We had kind of a Tabor amendment on the floor today, but we didn't get that far into it. But the 60% supermajority to raise the tax, so that kind of happens on the floor today. But really appreciate your comments. It's hard to know to keep your eye on the goal and not get lost in the pieces. so I really appreciate it. Questions? No. Thank you so much for sitting here and for waiting to tell us that. I appreciate it. Further testifiers. Is that it? You made it? Anyone else? We're done. Thank you so much. Well, please, everyone, keep talking to me. We are adjourned.